Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Many schools across the state are closed today because of the latest winter storm. That meant another snow day for kids and for many parents, a scramble for childcare. From handing the kids off to a friend or family member, or working from home, or just skipping work altogether. Either way, it's the latest reminder about the challenge and cost of daycare, whether or not there's a winter storm. According to the think tank New America and Care.com, families in Massachusetts pay an average of $1,100 a month for full-time daycare. That's about a third of a median household income, one-third. So it's a big challenge for a lot of families. So if K-12 education is a public right, why not daycare, as it is in many European countries? Joanna Weiss, contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion blog, wrote about this in the Boston Globe yesterday. Her piece is headlined, "Is Daycare Impossible? Why Individual Families Shouldn't Bear the Burden of Childcare Costs," and she joins us now. And Joanna, good to have you. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we'd love to get you into this conversation. How do you juggle daycare? Does it stretch your family budget? Is it time for universal government-subsidized daycare for Massachusetts, for the nation? We'd love to hear your take on this, your personal story. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So, Joanna, I wanted to start a little bit by just describing the daycare landscape and what it looks like. First of all, cost. We mentioned $1,100 a month on average in Massachusetts. That sounds like a huge chunk for many families to take on. Put that challenge in perspective for us.
It absolutely is. And it's, you know, on average in the nation, it's about $800 per month for that full-time center-based child care. And, you know, for a lot of families, that is, it's akin to having a second mortgage. And it's something that there are no loans, like you could get a loan to help you with college education. You can't really get a subsidized loan to help you with this. It's just something families are absolutely on their own. And at the same time, child care workers are, in many cases, living in poverty or needing public assistance because tuition alone can't really, you know, when you think about the ratios of teachers to students and the very razor-thin margins that child care centers operate under, child care professionals aren't making a lot of money off of this either. It's really an impossible economic situation.
Yeah, I think if I'm recalling the figure from your article, I mean, some of them are making, what, $9 or $10 an hour?
Median wage is $9.77 an hour.
Yeah, that's astounding. And then there's the question of how this system is organized, or maybe a better way to say it, how this system is not organized. I mean, what kind of challenge does this pose for families in terms of trying to find reliable, safe, good daycare nearby, local? I mean, it's all over the map, isn't it?
Well, once again, you're absolutely on your own with this. People cobble together a little bit of help from family, if family's in town, but in many cases, you're searching your options for full-time care that can accommodate a parent's hours and also a commute. You know, there are in-home options and there are center-based options and there are some wonderful ones out there, but it's an absolute challenge to find the right one that fits your lifestyle and then to pay for it.
Joanna Weiss, stand by. I want to bring in Barbara Beatty. I know you spoke to her, quoted her quite extensively in your piece. She's the professor of education and chair of education of the education department at Wellesley College and the author of Preschool Education in America. Barbara Beatty, thanks for joining us. We're very grateful.
And thank you for having me on the program.
So there's some interesting history that I wanted to start with you about, and that is that Congress had actually passed legislation for a kind of universal daycare a while back, but we clearly don't have it today. What happened?
Well, what happened was that in 1971, Walter Mondale, who later ran for president, as you know, and was beaten by Reagan, and John Brademas, so a senator and a congressman, created the Comprehensive Child Development Act. And it passed Congress, so both houses.
Hmm.
And what it included was all kinds of developmentally informed services for young children and families, including universal child care, health kinds of issues. I mean, it was really a Comprehensive Child Development Act. So we had it. There it was.
Both parties came together, both houses of Congress. It was passed. And what happened? President Nixon didn't like it.
It went to President Nixon's desk, exactly, and he vetoed it. And so you can think of this as being the highlight in the idea of there being a public responsibility for helping young children and families. He vetoed it, and the reason why he vetoed it is really important to hear. He vetoed this, it was called Legislative Framework for Universalization of Child Development Services, and here's the reason. Because it would commit the vast authority of the national government to the side of communal approaches to child rearing over against the family-centered approach. So what do you think of when you hear that?
I'm thinking of this idea that Joanna raised in her piece. She put it this way, that there's this idea out there that K-12 education is a job best done by professionals, but taking care of small children is a job best done by parents, which in most cases probably means mothers. I mean,
is it this old idea
that I guess killed it?
And I think it's important to frame this as a historian. So this was still the period of Cold War ideology.
I see.
So when you hear communal approaches, you should hear communism.
I see.
But the other irony here, and I think this is not an irony, I think it has something to do with it. Do you know what else was passed in 1972? So right after the Nixon veto?
What's that?
Title IX.
Ah, okay.
Title IX, which is the U.S. Education Amendment that gives all sorts of rights to women, right?
Yeah.
Title IX.
Very interesting.
So this is at the peak of, or at the beginning, when feminism is starting to get real public support, but sort of toward the end, this Cold War era ideology.
Well, Barbara and I have talked extensively about the idea of this public versus private divide, and when does the public responsibility take over, and when in our culture do we think of things belonging in the private sphere? And that gets caught up in, you know, ideas about gender, ideas about home life that are a bit outdated, given especially, you know, in today's economics, the majority of families now are either headed by two working parents or by a single parent. So we're talking about outdated ideas, and yet we really have a hard time as a society shaking that idea about the private sphere for young kids.
All right. Listen, listeners, you can join this conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the question, is it time for publicly funded child care in the same way that K-12 education is publicly funded and a right? Let's take a couple of calls. Brooks is calling from Newton. Brooks, I assume no relation to me, but what's on your mind?
Yeah, I'd just like to weigh in on this. You know, I think we're confusing in this country between a right and a privilege. And in my opinion, having children is a privilege, not a right. If you're going to have children, you should be prepared to put the financial responsibility and burden of having those children. That's not something that other people should be burdened with.
Brooks, I really appreciate you putting that idea on the table. Barbara, let me come to you and respond to Brooks, if you will, because, I mean, I guess my question would be K-12 education is certainly regarded as a right because in many ways it serves broader society, right?
Absolutely. And I think one of the divides, another way of looking at this divide, is between other people's children and everybody's children. So the private child and the public responsibility for all children. And one way, I think a way to understand this is to look at how hard it was for us to bring one more year of life, five-year-olds, into the public sphere. Because we think children should be able to go to kindergarten, don't we?
Absolutely, yeah.
I think that schools should provide kindergarten.
But it wasn't always there, you're saying, of course.
It wasn't always there, and
right.
It's still usually voluntary, not compulsory. But it wasn't there. And if we look at how it was that we got another year of life into the public sphere, and I would argue that it's in a kind of special place, that it's a transition zone. where children come out of the private family into the public sphere. And I'm sure parents feel that. I mean, the first time you drop your child off in kindergarten.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Terry is calling from Newton. Hi, Terry. You're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi. Thank you. So I just wanted to make a comment on the idea of a right to child care and having universal child care. I think different families have vastly different needs in terms of what they need for child care. I'm a grandmother. I raise two children working full time, and I have two grandchildren. And I think that the financial problem could be easily solved by, first of all, making all your child care payments 100% tax deductible, which they are not, and which actually can put a lot of burden on families. But if a business can deduct their secretary as a family, you should be able to deduct the full cost of your child care. And in certain income levels, I think there should be a tax credit or a rebate from the government on your taxes. You get money back in order to be able to pay for the child care. I think the idea of having a universal system would might satisfy a few people, but different people, different families have different needs. And I'm all for child care, and I'm all for not placing a burden on young families with lower income.
Well, Terry, you've put some proposals on the table, and that's sort of where I wanted to move this conversation next. And Joanna, I'll go to you for this. Barbara, too, by all means, chime in. As we know, what's being talked about, Ivanka Trump proposed a government benefit to help pay for daycare. So here's a political ad that was released in September before the election. This is Ivanka Trump talking about her father, Donald Trump.
My father will change outdated labor laws so that they support women and American families. He will provide tax credits for childcare, paid maternity leave, and dependent care savings accounts. This will allow women to support their families and further their careers.
And Joanna, of course, at the Republican National Convention, Ivanka Trump talked about this. So how would that work? And by the way, thanks to Terry, who was talking about tax credits in the same way that Ivanka Trump was there. How would that plan work?
Yeah, you know, and it's worth noting, by the way, that this presidential campaign was the first one in which both candidates from both parties talked about child care as an issue. So we're making some progress, at least in awareness on this issue. And yeah, I don't think that anyone is actually talking about subsidizing, creating a new school system of child care for everyone. It's a logistical and cost question that feels a little insurmountable at this point. What everyone's talking about in terms of actual policy proposals are things like dependent care savings accounts, earned income tax credits, things that are going to help families around the margins. And I think that I think it's realistic or possible that we can start to have some bipartisan conversations about that if the Trump administration is in fact actually on board.
Yeah. What do you think, Barbara? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I also think that we're moving toward changing how we think about young children. So with so many mothers of young children, I think, Joanna, you said it's 64% of children under six, but also we're starting to see now more the idea that young children, it's what I call, it's play learning, play-based learning, but that young children are learning a great deal before they even start kindergarten, and that we need to pay attention to the environments and the enrichment and the kinds of provision for play-based learning that we provide for all children. So there's this other divide between child care and preschool education that I'd like to mention that we need to bridge, because we think of when we say child care, and Joanna and your callers were saying this, who do we think of as the client? We think of the client as the mother. But when we say preschool education, we think of the client as the child. And I'm going to argue that we need to bridge that divide as well and start thinking about early childhood care and education as being something that's good for individual children, private families, and for all of us.
Although I do also want to bring up the idea that, I mean, Ivanka Trump's policy goal has a lot to do with labor participation for women, for mothers, and I think that's an important piece of the argument as well. We're taking care of children, but we're also allowing women to help their families to be independent in case of all kinds of contingencies that could happen in their lives. We're with child care assistance, we'd be helping people get education to better their family's economic status. So we're really talking about a policy that could help whole families.
See, this is really interesting because you raise this in the piece, Joanne, and I'm sure you know this history better than anyone, Barbara, and that is, I think you made the point, Joanna, that there have been times in our history when we had subsidized child care, essentially, and it was when we wanted to get women into the workforce, right?
It was a little more targeted, right? But it, you know, and it was times like the Depression where there were child care centers that were as much for the benefit of women working and helping their families as for the children. It was during World War II when you had Rosie the Riveter working on the base building the ships and there was child care provided for them. So yes, there are all kinds of social reasons. In European countries, there are a couple of countries that have quite explicitly subsidized child care in part because they wanted to boost fertility rates among young women. If it's easier to have children, more women will have kids.
And I want to add to that, because after Truman did away with the funding for the child care centers after World War II, and these centers were wonderful. I mean, they were 24/7. You could pick up meals, everything. What happened is that actually some states, California, you're not surprised, some states and some cities decided that this was so important that they were going to continue it. So I think where we need to look, where the action is in terms of universalizing responsibilities for children and helping families, it's at the state and local level.
Hmm. Let's go to Cynthia, who's calling from Providence with another question. Cynthia, you're on the air.
Thanks so much for taking my call. I really would beseech your guests to address the question that was brought up earlier by the gentleman caller that brought up the point between privilege and right. And again, I would like the ladies to address it. It was not addressed. And I truly feel it's a taboo that needs to be broken. We need to start talking about this issue.
All right, Cynthia. So that was Brooks who called, and Joanna and Barbara. And if you recall, the question was sort of, the distinction. If you bring kids into the world, that's a privilege. And that has to be distinguished between that you deserve a right to have that kid in subsidized daycare.
It's something that's an argument that I've heard so many times. I've been writing about child care and child and family issues for so many years, and there's someone always makes that precise comment, if you can't afford to have kids, then don't. And I would say we make decisions as a society about what we're going to subsidize and who we're going to support on so many different levels. I mean, you mentioned K-12 education. We've collectively agree that that's worth subsidizing. You can talk about Medicare. You can talk about Medicaid. You can talk about other people's vacation homes through FEMA. We're helping to support other people's vacation homes when they're damaged by storms, and public taxpayer money goes to fixing those.
How about middle-class mortgages, for example?
That too.
Yeah.
Well, and also, there's so much research showing that when we help all children in this way, it helps all of society. It pays off. There's Nobel Prize winner Jim Heckman's research on how much it pays off to help children this way. So this is not something that's just about a privilege. It's about how the children that are going to be in our society, our future, how this will help all of us and them.
Well, as you mentioned so well in your piece, Joanna, we've got a ways to go, but clearly we're talking about it. We've been talking to Barbara Beatty. She's professor of education and chair of education department at Wellesley College, author of Preschool Education in America. Barbara, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Joanna Weiss is a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Opinion and Ideas blog, and she wrote a Boston Globe piece, which you can link to at radioboston.org, Is Daycare Impossible? Joanna Weiss, thanks so much for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.